to start with a very difficult Rashi in the right away at the beginning of the Sedra. I don't know if we're going to cover more than this today, but at least if we do this properly, you'll understand quite a few interesting things. The Rashi says on the Pasuk, Vayeshev Yaakov, Bikesh Yaakov, Leshev Vishalva. Yaakov wanted to sit in peace, serenity, Shalva. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Lo dayin letzadikim mashem mesukan lohem la'olam haba. It's not enough for the tzadikim what they have set aside for them in the world to come. Umevakshim leishe b'shalva b'olam hazeh. And they want to have it easy, peaceful, serene in this world too. Miyad kofatz alav rogzo shel Yosef. Immediately, Yaakov was jumped upon by the agitation of Yosef, the whole parish of Yosef. Now that Rashi is very, very difficult. Because what does it make a difference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu if a tzaddik has it good in this world and the next world? What's so terrible? It says that not everybody has two tables, this world and the next world. But not everybody doesn't. There are many tzaddikim who had it good in this world and good in the next world. There's no rule that every tzaddik has to have a miserable life, can't have some peace and quiet. What was wrong with Yaakov Avinu? Bikesh Yaakov leishe b'shalva. Yaakov wanted, he had a right, he had a really difficult life up until there. All he wanted was a little peace and quiet, a little serenity. Leishe b'shalva. And Omer HaKadosh, God said, Lo dayin, it's not enough for tzaddikim what they have in the next world, they need this world too. Why not? So there is a Torah Tamima that says the following, that a terrible mistake crept into this Rashi. And that really, if you look in the Medrashim, there is a Medrash that says differently. The Medrash says the following, and then according to him, the question is not a question anymore. What does the Medrash say? Bikesh Yaakov leishe b'shalva. Yaakov wanted to sit in peace and quiet. Omar ha-Satan. The Satan said, it's not enough for tzaddikim what they have in the next world. They need this world too. So a terrible mistake crept into Rashi that in place of Omar ha-Satan, it says Omar ha-Kadosh Baruch Hu. But really it's the Satan who said this. And then there's no problem. The Satan can't fargin a tzaddik this world or the next world. So the Satan said, it's not enough for tzaddikim what they have in the next world, they need this world too. But not chas v'sholom, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said it. I really don't understand what the Torah Tamima fixed up by this. First of all, there are many Midrashim that say exactly what Rashi says. Secondly, what does this make anything better? The Satan does not run this world. The Satan is there only to bring suggestions. His job is to be makatrig, to bring an offense against people. But God is the one who decides whether he wants to accept that or not. And in the end, if the agitation of Yosef came about, it's because God wanted it to come about, not because the Satan did. Satan doesn't run the world. So we're back where we started. Obviously, God accepted the argument of the Satan. That means that God agreed. So we're back to where we started. That means that God said, the tzaddikim don't have enough in the next world, they need this world too. Mela God brought on Yosef, on Yaakov, the whole parsha of Yosef. So what is it? Why can't a tzaddik have it good in this world? So some say the problem is not that Yaakov couldn't have it okay in this world. It's that he asked for it. Bikesh Yaakov leishe b'shalva. So what? Don't we ask every day Mashiach should come? When Mashiach comes, we'll have nice, peaceful, serene circumstances. And we ask for it. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with asking for it. So what does this Rashi mean? Why can't a tzaddik have it good in this world? To make it worse, and nobody is to leave this class till I answer these questions, because I don't want you to be depressed or to get the wrong idea. I'm going to tell you two more medrashim that are even more troubling, if you don't understand them properly. The Medrash says there was a woman in history who had the peak of nachas that any woman could ever have. And her name was Elisheva Bas Aminadav, and the day in her life was the day that the Mishkan was dedicated. Shmini L'Miluim Rosh Chodesh, Nisan, the second year that they left Egypt. On that day, she saw her husband inducted as the first Kohen Gadol in history, Nachas. She saw her brother-in-law, Moshe Rabbeinu, the king of Israel. She saw her brother, Nachshon ben Aminadav, the first Nasi, to dedicate the altar on that day, on the Mizbeach, was dedicated. First Karban was Rosh Chodesh Nisan, was Nachshon ben Aminadav, her brother. And her children, her four children, were inducted that day to be the first Kohanim of the world. Her husband, the first Kohen Gadol, her children, the first Kohanim, her brother, the first Nasi to dedicate the Mizbeach, and her brother-in-law, Moshe Rabbeinu, Melech Yisrael. What more nachas could she have? And that day, two of her children were killed, Nadav and Avihu. We learn from there that simcha does not remain for anybody in this world. When people have simchas, there's always a monkey wrench. And as a rabbi who has been at many, many simchas, it's usually true. Every simcha has some kind of, sometimes, what's it called, the not so serious things, sometimes more serious things. I learned this lesson. We had Kenai Nahara, four girls first when we lived in Cleveland. We moved to Miami, and we had twin boys. And you can imagine, it was a big simcha. And I had one of the doctors of my shul came to me and said, please don't hire a photographer for the bris. I am an amateur professional photographer, and I want to do it for free. Okay? So he took all the pictures for the bris. And in those days, it wasn't digital. You had to wait to develop the film. So I figured, in a few days, I'm going to get the pictures. A week passed, 2 weeks passed, 3 weeks passed. One day, he shows up at my office with a very sheepish grin on his face. And he says, I can't put this off any longer. I got to tell you, something happened. Something was wrong with the film. There are no pictures. So I told him, Baruch Hashem. Really? I said, there's a tremendous simcha, and I always know something, there's something that always mars a simcha. This I can handle. Because other people took amateur pictures, right, with their own cameras, so there were pictures. So these pictures didn't come out, I can handle that. I was always wondering, what's going to happen that's going to mar this simcha, and I was afraid of something I couldn't handle. This I can handle. Okay, so every simcha, every wedding has something that always goes wrong, something, some kind of fight between the families or whatever, it's without fail. Simcha does not remain too long for anybody in this world. Now let me tell you the third medrash, which is even more troubling. The medrash says, again, simcha does not remain for anyone too long in this world. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why not? Because God said the following, when I created the world, I was extremely happy. Yismach Hashem b'maisav, God is happy with his handiwork. I was happy. And I didn't remain happy too long, because the first human beings that I created sinned and made me very unhappy. And if I couldn't remain happy, nobody's going to remain happy in this world. Now that sounds like God, sounds like a six-year-old spiteful, right? I couldn't remain happy, nobody's going to remain happy. So God doesn't let people stay happy too long because he couldn't stay happy too long. Very, very difficult medrash. So let me tell you what I think. What this is all about, and it's going to take a little while to explain, but it is so fundamental to what this world is all about and what our perspective on life is, that it's worth spending the entire shiur on this one Rashi instead of a lot of different things from the parsha. There's a lot of things in this sedra, but we'll satisfy ourselves with this. Let me tell you another medrash, and afterwards we'll start giving some answers. I'm going to paraphrase the medrash for you, but if you want to look it up, it's in Koheles Rabbah on the pasuk Me'uvas Lo Yuchal Lisko, and I think it's the end of Perek Aleph in Koheles. Koheles Rabbah. The medrash says like this: there were once two Rishoyim who were partners in crime their entire life. They murdered, they stole, really despicable people. And one of them died, and he went to Gehenna. And he's suffering in Gehenna for many months, years, it doesn't say how long. And one day he looks up, and he sees that they are escorting the neshama of his partner into Gan Eden. So he calls the angel that is appointed over the neshamas in Gehenna, and he says, there must have been a computer error. That's my partner. When I murdered, he murdered. When I stole, he stole. Why is he in Gan Eden and me in Gehenna? If he belongs in Gan Eden, so do I. Get me out of here. And if I belong in Gehenna, so does he. Bring him here to keep me company. Somebody's a mistake. So the Malach comes back and he says, we checked it out. No mistake. He belongs there, you belong here. He said, I get it. He bribed somebody. So just tell me who and how much. I will double the amount. Just get me out of here. The Malach says, I'm sorry, but there is no bribery here. So he says, then tell me, why am I in Gehenna and he in Gan Eden? We were partners. He said, you don't know what happened after you died. You see, after you died, you dropped dead one day in the street. And nobody wanted to bury you. You were such a despicable person, they just left your body rot in the street for 3 days. After 3 days, some benevolent person came and kicked your body into a hole in the side of the road, and that's where you're buried. When your partner saw this, it made such an impression on him that he started to rethink his whole life. Is this the way I want to end up? Buried in the side of the road, kicked into a hole? And he thought about his whole life, and he repented, and he died a fully repentant person, a tzaddik. So he's in Gan Eden, and you're in Gehenna. You never repented. You didn't let anything in your life affect you. You died a Russian. So you're in Gehenna. The guy said, this is great. I thought it's going to cost me money. I'm willing to do tshuva. Just tell me what to say. Oshamnu, al-chait. I really regret what I did. If I would have known where I'm going to end up, I never would have done it. I'll never do it again. Oshamnu, bogadnu. Get me out of here. The Malach said, I'm sorry, but it's a little late. Don't you know that the world you came from is like Erev Shabbos? And the world you're in now is like Shabbos. If you prepare on Erev Shabbos, you have what to eat on Shabbos. You didn't prepare anything on Erev Shabbos. You should have done tshuva before you came. But now you're in Shabbos. Now it's too late to prepare. It's like somebody wants a meal on Shabbos, you have to prepare it Erev Shabbos. Shabbos, you wake up Shabbos, too late. You can't do anything to make a meal on Shabbos. You should have done tshuva before you got here. You don't do tshuva in this world, you do tshuva in the world you came from. And don't you know, the Malach continued, that the world you came from is like the dry land, and the world you're in now is like the sea. If you prepare your boat with supplies on the dry land, you have what to eat in the middle of the ocean. But you set sail with an empty boat. Now you want to supply it with supplies? There's no supermarket in the middle of the ocean. Now you're in the middle of the ocean. Now it's too late to supply your boat. You should have done tshuva and supplied yourself before you set sail to this world. You do tshuva in the other world, not here. And don't you know, the angel continued, the world you came from is like the yishuv, like the city. And the world you're in now is like the desert. If you prepare yourself in the city, you're able to survive in the desert. You didn't prepare yourself. Now it's too late to get a survival kit. Now you're in the desert. So the man realizes that everything that he did is distorted and he can't correct it. and he bemoans his fate. That's the Medrash. Two things bothered me about this Medrash. Firstly, there is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that compares this world to the next world. Ha'olam hazeh dome leprozdor bifnei ha'olam haba. This world is like a preparation room to a castle. Prepare yourself in the preparation room in order that you should go into the castle. Why didn't the angel tell him a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos? Didn't you know the world you came from is like the preparation room, and the world you're in now is like the castle? You didn't prepare yourself in the preparation room, you can't get in the castle. Too bad. Why did he tell him three analogies? Erev Shabbos and Shabbos, the dry land and the sea, the city and the desert, and not tell him a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos? Secondly, why was it necessary to tell this guy three mishalim, three analogies? I'm sure the guy got the message after the first one. They basically are saying the same thing. It's too late. Should have prepared yourself before you came here. So why was it necessary to tell him three analogies which basically say the same thing? So one of my balabatim once told me, who's now one of my mechutanim taka, he said, Rabbi, you don't understand. That's Gehenim, listening to long drushes that aren't necessary. That's why he told him three mishalim that weren't necessary. But as a rabbi, I don't accept that. So, why taka? Why was it necessary to tell him three mishalim and not the one from Pirkei Avos? In order to understand this, one more question. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Yofa sho'achas shel koras ruach ba'olam haba mikol chayei olam hazeh. 1 second of koras ruach. Koras ruach means peripheral pleasure. I'll give you a marshal what that means in a second. In Olam Haba is better than the entire life in this world. 1 second of peripheral pleasure in Olam Haba is greater than the whole life in this world. Let me tell you what that means, what the Bali Musar say. What's peripheral pleasure? Koras ruach. Imagine if there's a banquet being prepared and you're not invited. You can't even get into the hall to see the food, let alone eat it. What you can do is walk outside the hall and get a whiff of the aroma of the foods that's cooking. That's it. You never saw the food. You surely never tasted the food. All you got was an aroma of the food cooking. That's called koras ruach. That's peripheral enjoyment. 1 second of that kind of enjoyment in Olam Haba is greater than all life in this world. Take all the human beings that ever lived, from Adam Harishon till the end of time, all the pleasure they ever had in their lives, all of it, put it all together, have tremendous pleasure. All of that is nothing compared to 1 second of this peripheral pleasure in Olam Haba. That seems to say that this world is nothing, is worthless compared to the world to come. But there's another Mishnah. There's another Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says, Yofa sho'achas shel tshuvo ma'isim tovim ba'olam hazeh mikol chayei olam haba. That 1 second of repentance and good deeds in this world is greater than the whole next world. So which is it? The first Mishnah seems to say the next world is much greater than this world. And this Mishnah seems to say this world is greater than the next world. So which is it? So if we were academians, scholars, we would say that there are two schools of thought amongst the rabbis. There are the this-worldly rabbis and the other-worldly rabbis. Some rabbis like this world, some rabbis like the next world. So it's two different schools of thought. There's only one problem. The same rabbi, Rabbi Yaakov, said both of these Mishnayos. And he wasn't schizophrenic. He didn't argue with himself. So there's got to be some qualification when this world is better than the next world, and some qualification when the next world is better than this world. So what is it? So let me tell you what I think. There are two very different philosophies of life. One, a secular philosophy, and one, the Torah's philosophy. The secular philosophy of life goes something like this. It has many manifestations, but it all boils down to the same bottom line. I once saw on a T-shirt in New York that they were selling like hotcakes. It had one sentence on it. It said, the one who has the most toys when he dies wins. That was what it said on the T-shirt. That is basically a secular philosophy of life. What does it mean? Toys are things that give you pleasure. They're things, experiences, whatever. Anything that gives you pleasure is a toy. When you are little, the toys are little. When you get bigger, the toys get bigger. The purpose of life is to amass toys, pleasure. As much pleasure as you can have. Things, experiences, whatever it may be. And the one who has the most pleasure during his life wins. The one who has the most toys wins. That's a successful life. Now, I was looking for an asterisk with a footnote on this T-shirt, what exactly you win at that point, since you're dead. So, and then I heard about a woman in L.A. who asked to be buried not in a casket, but to be buried in her Rolls Royce, which they did. They buried her in her Rolls Royce. She had the biggest, most expensive toy, and she got to be buried in it. She won. Exactly what she benefited from that, I'm not sure. I'm sure her gas mileage at that point was great since she wasn't going anywhere. So she won the game. The one who has the most toys when they die win. Now, if that is your philosophy of life, which I hope it's not because that's not our philosophy of life, then life is extremely depressing. Because if that's all that life is, the amount of seconds between the time you're born and the time that you die, and how many toys you can amass between those two points in time, then we can depict life in the following very depressing way. Imagine a man standing outside the delivery room, waiting for news of his wife's impending birth. And the doctor or the midwife comes out and says, "I have very, very sad news for you. Your wife just gave birth to a baby, but the baby was born with a terminal disease which it can't survive. Your baby is for sure going to die of the disease it was born with." So the father says to the doctor, "Doctor, give me some hope. There's a cure." "No, there's no cure." "You're looking for a cure." "Nah, we stopped looking for a cure long ago." "Somebody survived this terrible disease miraculously without a cure." "Never. Not in the annals of medical history." Guy says, "I never heard of such a terrible disease. There's no cure. You're not looking for a cure. No one ever survived the disease miraculously. What is the name of this terrible disease that my child was born with?" The doctor says, "You see, when your child was born, he contracted the disease we call life. Some people have survived 50 years, 70 years, 90 years, 100. We don't know how long it's going to take, but we know one thing for sure. Whoever is born with the disease called life eventually dies from it. So your child was born with the disease called life, and he's eventually going to die from it. There's no way of surviving it. If all life is the seconds between when you're born and you die, if you figure out how many seconds you're going to live, right, we're all going to live 120 years in Mitzvah. So let's figure out how long that is. Multiply 365 by 120. Now you have how many days in 120 years. Multiply that by 24. Now you have how many hours in 120 years. Multiply that by 60. Now you have how many minutes in 120 years. Multiply that by 60. Now you have how many seconds. Big number. Put it on a digital display and put it up in the delivery room. And the moment you're born, push the button, and what happens? The numbers start to go backwards towards zero. As soon as you're born, you begin to die. And that's all that life is. It's a long death. It's a disease that you eventually die from. That's life is. And I didn't mean to depress you. That's not our idea of life. But that is the life of somebody who doesn't believe in anything more than birth and death. So when you're born, you begin to die. And that's exactly the life of Rishoyim. Rishoyim b'chayehem nikroyim mesim. We normally translate that to mean Rishoyim, even when they live, are called dead. But I think you can translate it differently. Rishoyim b'chayehem, Rishoyim as they live, nikroyim mesim, they are called dying. Because that's what they're doing. They're dying slowly. They're born and every second they get closer to dying. Because there's nothing more to life. They're born, they fill up their lives with pleasure, and eventually they die. So as soon as they're born, they begin to die. The clock starts ticking backwards. That is the secular view of life. And that doesn't necessarily mean that people who believe that live meaningless lives. Because pleasure is all kinds of pleasure. People who are very unrefined, their pleasure is eating, drinking, and all the other kind of physical pleasures. But there are people in this world whose pleasure is going to the opera. Good culture. There's people even a higher level. Their pleasure in life is working for the Peace Corps, volunteering for kindness, helping other people. But basically they do it for one reason, because they enjoy it. And I was put in this world to enjoy what I want to do with my life. Some people enjoy eating. Some people enjoy opera. Some people enjoy helping other people. But basically, it's all toys. I do it because I enjoy it, because it's pleasurable to me. If that's all that life is, you're born, eventually die, fill it up with what you consider pleasure, it's all the same. And that's why there are many people in this world who reach midlife, their 40s, 50s, and they get very depressed because they begin to realize that what's it all worth? And time is ticking by very fast, and eventually they're not going to have any pleasure. They're going to die, and what did they accomplish? So there are a lot of depressed people who are lying on psychiatrist couches telling them how depressed they are, and the psychiatrists themselves are also depressed. A lot of depressed people in this world who have a lot of pleasure but eventually realize that it's slowly, time is running out, and what do they gain? What do they accomplish? That is not the Torah's view of life. The Torah's view of life doesn't start when you're born, and it doesn't end when you die. Life started for all of us at Briyas HaOlam, either the first day of creation or the second day, Shiloh, when our neshamas were created. But it was created way back then, and we were our neshamas. That's the first thing. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting around inside of us, called a neshama. We are neshamas. We were created as neshamas, and we live for thousands of years in a spiritual world as neshamas. And as neshamas, we could see without eyes, and we could hear without ears, and we could get around without arms and legs. Except when we came into this physical world, which we'll discuss in a second, why we came into this physical world, we needed a spacesuit, like an astronaut, to be able to function. In a physical world, the neshama can't function without a body. In a spiritual world, it can function very nicely without a body. Just like an astronaut, as long as he's on terra firma of the earth, he can function very nicely without a spacesuit. He can breathe, he can talk, everything. But when he goes into outer space, there is no atmosphere, so there's no oxygen, he needs an oxygen apparatus. There's no pressure, air pressure, he needs a pressurized suit. There's no sound waves, so he needs a radio to speak through. When he comes back to earth, he takes off the suit. He doesn't need it anymore. As long as we were neshamas in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without a body. We came into the physical world, we needed a body, a spacesuit to wear. Our neshamas now wear that body to function. Eyes to see and ears to hear and so on. We go back to the spiritual world, we leave the body here. Just like the astronaut takes off the spacesuit. Doesn't need it anymore. And we can function very nicely there as a neshamas. So, why did God create us? What was the purpose of creation? Why did God have to create neshamas for? So the rabbis tell us the following. This is what we have a mesorah from God, why he created us. This does not answer the question, why did God create the world the way he did? That question we can't answer. This answers a different question. Once God created the world the way he did, what can we understand about it? And I'll tell you in 1 second why it's necessary to make that distinction. Sounds the same, but it's not. What the rabbis tell us is the following. God, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creation that could receive that ultimate good, which is him. Meaning God wanted to shower himself on a creation that he could have a relationship with eternally. So he created neshamos, which are the closest thing to him. They're a chelek eloka mimal. They are a kibiyachol, a part of God. And he could have just showered his presence eternally on those neshamos and gave them that pleasure of having a connection with God eternally. And that would have been the purpose of creation. Again, God, being the ultimate good, wanted to do good and shower his goodness on this creation. Except God knew that if he showered that goodness just like this for free, it wouldn't be the ultimate good. Because people appreciate what they earn, not what they get for free as much. And therefore, God took the neshama and he put it in a physical world distance from him. And he said, you create the relationship with me instead of me creating it with you. You earn it, more than earn it. We'll see, you create it. So he put our neshamas in this world. We come into this world and we have the ability to create that relationship with God. In 1 second, I'll describe to you how we do that. But the question that can be asked on this at this point is a very serious question. And that is the following. We're saying now that God really could have just showered his goodness, his presence on a neshama that he created and put it right away into the world to come. What is the world to come? Tzadikim yoshvim, va'atroseihem barashehem, v'nehenem izivashchina. The neshamos have a close, intimate relationship with God. That is Olam Haba. So God could have created the world to come, put our neshamas there, and showered his presence on us. And finished. Why didn't he do that? Because he knew that we wouldn't appreciate it totally. Because you don't appreciate what you get for free as much as what you earn. The obvious question is, who made that rule? God could have saved a lot of time and money. He didn't have to create this world. All he had to do was change one rule. He should have created neshamas that can appreciate what they don't earn. That would have made it easier. Instead of making that rule that people appreciate what they earn more than they don't earn, change the rules. Create a neshama that can appreciate what it doesn't earn. And then just create Olam Haba. You wouldn't have to create this world altogether. Why didn't God do that? The answer to that question is, there is no answer that we can understand. There is no answer to that. Not because we're not allowed to think about it, because it's impossible. That question is a question before creation. Why couldn't have God created the world differently? Our minds have no connection to something out of our realm. We can only relate to things within our realm. Something outside our realm, our minds have no connection to, and we can't even think about it. Let me prove it to you. Imagine, close your eyes, not too tightly, close your eyes and imagine nothing, nothingness. Okay? You picture nothingness. Take your hand and put it into the nothing. Your hand's now in the middle of that nothing. That's not nothing. That's space. Try again. Picture nothing but no space. You get a headache. Forget it. You can't do it. Why can't you do it? Because we have no connection, no point of reference to no space. Our realm, right, our framework is always space. So we can't even imagine no space. Our minds can't picture it. I'll give you another example. Imagine something in your mind that you never saw and never heard of. It's impossible. If you never saw and never heard of it, you can't possibly imagine it. What can you imagine? A monster with 10 heads, 5 legs, 6 arms. But you heard and saw, you heard and saw arms, legs, heads. You just put a lot of them together. but something you never heard of and never saw at all is impossible to imagine. It's out of your framework. There's no way of conjuring it up even. We can only imagine and relate to things that are in our realm, from the creation of the world within the world. We can't even relate to God except as a creator of the world. The greatest name we have for God, which means that we can relate to him, is Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. Yud-Kei Vav-Kei means God brought about the existence of the world. He is the Mahave of the world. But God before the world, not related to the world, we have no name for him. We have no way of relating to him. We can't ask questions of what came before the world was created because it's beyond our realm. It's not that it's us to do. It's impossible. Our minds have no grasp of something outside of our realm. To ask a question, why couldn't God have created the world differently, is asking a question on God before creation. That's something that our minds can't possibly fathom. So what can we ask? Once God created the world the way we know it, what can we understand about it? Why it couldn't have been different is beyond our comprehension. Why it exists the way that it does, that we can ask. So once we know the world was created with that rule, that people, the fact is that people appreciate what they earn more than what they don't earn, what they get for free. So why, what can I understand about that? Why it couldn't have been different? That question we can't answer. So we're only answering the question, not why did God create the world the way he did, but once God created the world the way he did, what can we understand about it? Okay. If that's the case, so the Rabban Shalom put us in this world because he wanted us to earn the world to come. Now, many people make the mistake to think that that works like a Purim carnival. Purim carnival, you have all these games to play, and if you win, you get coupons. At the end of the day, if you have a lot of coupons, you go and cash them in at the prize booth, you get a big bear. If you have a little bit of coupons, you get a little bear. And they think that that's what Olam Haba is. In this world, there are games to play called mitzvahs. Unfortunately, there are other games that you can get demerits. They're called averus. You play games during your life, you get points, you get demerits. After 120 years, they punch your name into this master computer, they add up all your points, they give you a coupon, go cash it in for a share in the world to come by the prize booth. It doesn't work like that, because that would not be the ultimate pleasure. Let me give you an example. Imagine if you wanted one of these plush, lazy boy reclining chairs. You were dreaming of it. When will I get this chair that I could sit in, you know, and just sit there for the rest of my life? And you were hoping that somebody's going to buy it for you for your birthday. And somebody bought it for your birthday, and they give it to you as a present, and you sit in the chair. Do you think you'd enjoy the chair? Yes. But what about if nobody gave it to you as a present? Your birthday came, and they gave you, earrings. They didn't give you the chair. And you really want the chair. So you decided that you're going to have to earn money and buy the chair yourself. So you go to work, and you work for a month, 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, to be able to earn enough money to buy the chair. And after a month of hard work, you have enough money to go to the store and buy the chair, you bring it home, you sit in it. Do you think you would appreciate it more, enjoy it more, than if somebody gave it to you as a present? 100%. You spent a month working for that chair. So it's much more enjoyable now when you sit in it, because this is something that you earned, you put in a lot of hard work. But what would be the following? You didn't buy the chair. You didn't get it as a present. You planted trees and nurtured them for years till you could cut them down and cut them into lumber and make the frame of the chair. You then mined iron, made it into nails, and banged the frame together. You raised sheep, sheared their wool, made the stuffing of the chair. Raised cotton, spun it into thread, made it into the upholstery of the chair. And now you sat in the chair. Do you think you'd appreciate it even more than if you bought it? So what do you see? What you get for free, you don't appreciate as much as what you earn. And what you earn, you don't appreciate as much as what you actually create. So in order for the world to come to be the ultimate, you have to create it. not earn it. And that's what we do. We create our world to come. How do we do that? By doing mitzvahs, and not just mitzvahs. Torah is just an example. By doing everything in this world in a way that is godly. How do you know what's godly? The Torah tells you what's godly. If you function in this world in a godly way, how you eat, how you drink, how you conduct your married life, your social life, your economic life, is godly, then you make your neshama more like God, and after 120 years, you have a closer relationship to Him. If you do things that are less godly, you have less of a relationship with God. You create that relationship with God throughout your life. And what you have after 120 years is your creation. It's not something you earn. It's something you create. And therefore, every second in this world, you can create more and more eternity. Because every second you can do something. Think, speak, act in a way that is godly or not godly. And in that way, make your neshama more godly or less godly. The Gemara says that there was a Rasha who lived his whole life doing sins. And something happened and shocked him into doing tshuva. And his tshuva was so intense that he died. And a bas kol resounded, Ashrecha Rebbe Lazar ben Dordoi shemezumen l'olam haba. A bas kol went out that he entered the world to come. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, cried when he heard this maisa. And he said, Yeshkona olamo b'sho'achas. You can acquire your Olam Haba in 1 second. This is what this guy did in 1 second. So the Tzitzit Rosh Yeshiva asked, why was Rabbi Yehuda Anasi crying? He should have been elated. Wow, you can get your Olam Haba in 1 second. Why did he cry? He said, because he realized then you could do it every second. It's not just one Olam Haba. Olam Haba is eternal and it's also infinite. In mathematics, there is an infinite amount of whole numbers, theoretically. But there's also an infinite amount of fractions between each whole number. Between 1 and 2, there's an infinite amount of fractions. And between 1 and there is no end to the numbers, there's an infinite amount of whole numbers. That means there's an infinite amount of infinities. So in Olam Haba, there's an infinite amount of eternities. There's no end. You can always do more. Every second you can create more eternity. So that's what Rabbi Anasi cried. Every second you can create eternity, how many seconds do we let slip through our fingers and do nothing? Something to cry about. In any case, if you look at the world from a Torah perspective, then life is extremely important. Every second is intrinsically important on any level. You can be in a coma in a hospital. The only thing you can do, perhaps, is think. Okay? And just because the EEG shows flat brain waves doesn't mean you're not thinking. It either means the machine is not sensitive enough to pick it up, or you're not thinking through your brain, but your neshama can still think. And as long as you're alive, even thinking can make you closer to God. You can think about doing tshuva, you can think about believing in God, fearing God, loving God. You can think about mitzvahs that you can't do and want to do them as if you did them, because you can't do them, and you want to do them. It's considered like you did them. So every second, even on the lowest quality of life, you can do and create eternity in a second. From a secular standpoint, there is no intrinsic value to life. No 1 second of life is important, because the importance of life is to acquire pleasure. How much pleasure can you get in 1 second? Almost nothing. So in order for life to be important, you need quantity, a lot of seconds, and you need quality. If you're 119 and you don't have any teeth and you can barely hear and barely see and can't taste anything, so your life is not worth too much. You don't have quality of life, you don't have quantity of life. But if you're 20 years old and all your faculties are strong, then you have a quality life and quantity of life. So from a secular standpoint, life is not intrinsically valuable. It depends on how much quality and how much quantity. From a Torah standpoint, every second of life is extremely eternally valuable, because in 1 second you can create eternity. every second of life in this world is eternally valuable. Therefore, if you look at this world as an end in itself, this world is the place for pleasure, then as pleasure, the next world has this world beat hands down. This world is nothing compared to the world to come if you look at it as an end in itself. But if you look at this world as a means to reach an end, this is the world to create eternity, then it's even better than the world to come. Because here you can constantly create more and more, and there you're stuck with what you have. So the Mishnah that says that this world is greater than the next world is if you have a Torah perspective. The Mishnah that says this world is nothing compared to the next world is if you have a secular perspective. Now let's go on one more point. Now let's go back to the Medrash. Here is a Rasha who lived his whole life in sin. You can't come to him and tell him the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which is the real perspective of life. This world is a preparation room to a castle. Prepare yourself in the preparation room to go in the castle. What does that tell me? There is no other purpose to this world than to prepare for the world to come. You don't make a preparation room for any other purpose than to prepare. You don't equip it with anything except things to prepare to go in the castle. And you don't do anything there except prepare to go in the castle. The entire purpose, everything that exists, and the entire what you're supposed to do here is prepare for Olam Haba. That doesn't mean you sit in the corner and say Tillim. It means that everything in life, everything, your married life, social life, everything, can be done in a way that makes you more godlike or less godlike. And that is the purpose of this world. Everything that was created, everything, was created to use somehow to prepare for the world to come. That's it. But go tell a Rasha that that's the whole purpose of life. He didn't understand that. He doesn't understand it now. Therefore, the Malach said to the Rasha, look, you may not have understood that the entire purpose of this world is to prepare for the next world. That's why it was created. In your mind, maybe, Olam Hazeh is like Erev Shabbos. And Olam Haba is like Shabbos. Not the same thing. The whole purpose of Erev Shabbos is not for the sake of Shabbos. You eat breakfast Erev Shabbos, you go to work for a while. The major part of Erev Shabbos is preparing for Shabbos, but not totally. Maybe that's your understanding. This world's a nice place, but the main thing is preparing, but not all, everything. So why don't you prepare? And even if that you didn't understand, and in your mind, this world and the next world were equal, like the dry land and the sea, both nice places. This is a nice place, that's a nice place. But one day you knew your boat was going to sail. Why didn't you prepare? And if that you didn't understand, and in your mind this world was the main thing, this is the city, and the next world is a desert, meaningless, wasteland for you, but you knew that one day you're going to have to go into that wasteland, you have no choice, why don't you prepare a survival kit? And if that you didn't do, it either is that you didn't believe there's a world to come, or you just didn't care. Either way, you don't deserve it. That's why the Malach told him the three Mishalim. No matter what you believed, you should have prepared. But he didn't tell him the main thing because he knew he didn't understand that. The main one is that this world's purpose is solely to prepare for the world to come. If that's the case, we're getting close to the Rashi and to the Medrashim that we said. And we're also getting close to the end of the Shir. Let me tell you a story, and then you can understand the Rashi. When I was about 7, 8 years old, the supermarket in my neighborhood in Miami had a contest. And the winner of the contest, the first prize, was 15 minutes in the supermarket to grab off the shelves for free whatever you could. And I remember a woman won the contest, and they invited the entire neighborhood to watch her claim her prize. So I went with my brothers, Aleihem HaShalom, and I remember that she had bought special sneakers so she could run fast, you know, and grab as much as she could. She had two shopping carts, one on each arm, so she didn't run out of space of putting the things in. And she had a map of the supermarket connected to some contraption on her head, so it was right in front of her, with the most expensive aisles marked off, so she went there first. They told her, lady, look, you have 15 minutes. Whatever you grab off the shelves in 15 minutes is yours. When we blow the whistle the second time after the 15 minutes, if you grab anything then, it's ours. It's not yours anymore. So they told her, ready, get set, go, and she started running like a meshugana through the aisles, grabbing things, putting them in a shopping cart. If somebody would have come to her about 2-3 minutes into this, she was sweating, panting from running, and they would have said to her, lady, you look very tired. Here's a chair. Why don't you have a seat? Sit for a few minutes, rest up, and then you can continue on. You know what she'd say? Are you out of your mind? I have 15 minutes to grab what I can. Every second I sit, I'm wasting time. I have to grab as much as I can. You want to bring me a chair? At the end of the 15 minutes, bring me the chair. I'll sit for the next 5 hours. Not now. Now's a time to grab. Now I can't waste time. Now listen to the Rashi, just read a little bit differently. Bikesh Yaakov leishev v'shalva. The problem is not the shalva. You can have peace and quiet in this world. The problem is remaining peace and quiet. A person is put into this world to grab and prepare Olam Haba, to get as much eternity as you can. Every second you get more and more. And every second you don't do anything, you're losing eternity. So it's like the supermarket. Every second, you have 15 minutes. 120 years is not too much more than 15 minutes. And you have to grab. To stay at rest is counterproductive. Leishev, by Yeshev Yaakov. He just wanted time out. There's no time out. If you have peace and quiet, use it to now put your efforts into getting more Olam Haba. But to take it easy in this world completely and do nothing productive, that doesn't mean you don't have to sleep sometimes. It's also productive. But just to take it easy for the sake of taking it easy is counterproductive. And therefore, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo Dayan Tzadikim Asher Mesukan Lehem. It's never enough for a tzaddik what he already has in the world to come. U'mevakshim Reishei B'Shalva, and he wants to take it easy in this world? It's like the woman sitting down in the middle of the 15 minutes. I'm not going to let him do it. It's counterproductive. And therefore, anyone who ever felt fulfilled in this world, where they feel that they can just rest on their laurels and not be productive and dynamic, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes that feeling away. Don't feel accomplished. Don't feel fulfilled. Because if you feel fulfilled, it's counterproductive. Then what's this world all about? Elisheva Basaminadav felt, that's it. What else do I have? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw to it that she felt she needed more in this world. That she didn't reach it. She wasn't completely fulfilled. And therefore, Simcha doesn't stay for anybody in this world. It doesn't stay in a way that people feel fulfilled because that's counterproductive. You always have to feel that you need to do more. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. When I created the world, I could have remained happy, God said. I could have made a perfect world. I didn't have to make a world where people could sin. I could have remained happy if I wanted to, but that wasn't the purpose of creation. The purpose of creation was to give people the chance to create the world to come, not to be perfect in this world, to reach towards perfection. And therefore, I left the possibility that people could sin. And I didn't remain happy because that is not the purpose of this world, to remain happy. It's not why I created it. And therefore, nobody's going to remain happy. That's the purpose. You can be happy in this world, but not feel totally fulfilled, because then it's counterproductive and you're not accomplishing anything here. There's nothing to accomplish. So God's not spiting us. He's just saying, I could have created a world that was perfect, but I didn't, because that wasn't the purpose of this world. The purpose of this world is that it should be imperfect so people can perfect it and always strive towards perfection but never reach it. So if I didn't create the world to remain happy, because that wasn't the purpose, then people won't remain happy. Because if they remain happy, then they'll feel fulfilled and they won't accomplish what they're supposed to accomplish in this world. That's what it means. And that's what it says. Bikesh Yaakov leishev b'shalva. He wanted to remain inactive, serene, quiet. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Lo dayin letzadikim asher mesukan lemabor. It's never enough what a tzaddik has in the world to come. Not Isn't it enough what he has in the world to come? That's not the way God said it. He said it's never enough. You could always have more. You could always create more eternity. And he wants to remain quiet in this world. It's not productive for him. I'm going to make sure that he's agitated. And he has more to do in this world. And he doesn't feel complete and fulfilled. And he's dynamic. He'll earn more. He'll have more seconds of eternity that he'll create throughout his lifetime. That's what's best for a tzaddik, for anybody. But even for a tzaddik. Yes. He wanted, Yaakov Avinu wanted 5 seconds time out. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that's counterproductive. Those 5 seconds translate into 5 eternities. For him, it's not worth it to give him the 5 seconds. Yeah.
Didn't he want it so that he could be more productive?
That what?
Didn't he want it so he could be more productive? Like,
HaKadosh Baruch Hu sensed that if Yaakov would have that feeling of shalva, that it would take away from his productivity and his dynamism. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I'm not going to give it to him because it's not for his in his best interest.